Okay, well, bye-bye.
Well, good evening, afternoon, or midnight, depending on what part of the globe you're listening to the show. This is the Reverend Dr. John St. Germain bringing you another episode of Crystal Silence League Hour, sponsored by LMC Radio Network, the good people at Lucky Mojo Curio Company. Doc, we have a wonderful show for you tonight. Our stone of the week is Heliodor. Our guest is Mr. Ron Shank, a psychic worker who's semi-retired now. He's been devoting his time... he's an author, and he's been devoting his time to authoring and teaching workshops. He's going to talk to us tonight about his book, Three Steps to Consciousness, Wake Up, and we look very much forward to that. So stay tuned. Let us have a brief moment while you get your crystal balls. Those of you who don't have crystal balls, why not? You can always use some shiny thing, a stone, a crystal, or... if you like, a glass of water will suffice. So grab a crystal ball, grab a drink, and we'll see you in just a moment or so. Back. Again, I'm the Reverend Dr. John St. Germain. You can call me John. Crystal Silence League Hour. For those of you who don't know, the Crystal Silence League was founded around 1917 by Mr. Claude Conlin with the purpose of sending and distributing and projecting prayer and positive affirmation for those who needed it. And when Mr. Conlin passed into the afterlife, the Crystal Silence League went with him until it was revived in internet form by a group of spiritual adepts who were members of Missionary Independent Spiritual Church. And in its online form, prayer is always free. You can go to www.crystalsilenceleague.org and, of course, post your prayer online. You can also become a member of Crystal Silence League, and there are added benefits. Mr. Conlin, of course, wrote two books on the use of crystal ball work. One is called Crystal Gazing, and one is called Codes and Techniques for Crystal Gazing, both of which are available through the Crystal Silence League and Lucky Mojo Curio Company. You get one of these free if you buy a crystal or a crystal ball of $5 or more value. The prayer requests are posted, and there's a button you click that lets people know that they're praying that they're praying for you. And every time someone clicks on that, you get an email affirmation. And it's been our custom since I started the show to read some of these prayers aloud. I only identify them by prayer number and initials so that nobody is embarrassed, although people do put their names online. So those of you who wish to pray along with me, take a deep breath, clutch your crystal balls, and let's go. The first one, prayer ID number 37481BH, who is praying for reconciliation and justice with his or her twin flame. They're suffering from an unjust separation. They're crossed in every way possible by a third party, and they pray fervently for reconciliation and uncrossing from this future interference. May they be uncrossed, and may they soon be reconciled. Prayer ID number 37480 AJ needs curses removed and prays that all higher spirits will return all curses, spells, and enchantments and black magic to the people who sent them to them. Prayer ID number 37479 DF needs to pray that she passes her driver's exam on April 29th. May she pass that test so that she can get her driver's license. I believe this is a professional driver's license, to become a professional driver. Prayer ID number 37478, there's a love triangle, and she prays for help and guidance, caught in the middle of a dangerous love triangle and trying to work out these delicate relationship matters. So may that be reconciled very soon. Prayer ID number 37477, AG, needs healing in this relationship between herself and E. May that relationship soon be healed. That's been going on for a while, I believe. Prayer ID number, that's hard to read, 37476, KM, prays for a financial miracle, debt cancellation and relief, and prays for success of a magazine that KM has launched, and that he or she has everything she needs to sustain it. May that come true. Prayer ID number 37475, SW, has money concerns and requests that she become less frightened in the presence of poverty in lean times and better able to understand how to handle finances. May this insight and may this courage come to her. Prayer ID number 37474SW needs emotional healing within her heart, that she becomes less afraid of romance and able to turn to them with more courage. Prayer ID number 37473S needs to recover what his enemy, Mr. A, has stolen from him. Prayer ID number 37472VH, facing the SAT exam, needs a high score. May he be brilliant. May he pass this quickly. Prayer ID number 37471MN has a female interfering with a relationship with MP, prays that this female be removed from the relationship so that she can go on with that, with the relationship with her man. Prayer ID number 37470CR needs forgiveness and needs her beloved C to forgive her and accept her apologies. May forgiveness enter his heart. Prayer ID number 37469GS. And prayers like this always touch me especially. Please heal her cat, V, who's lost weight and developed breathing problems. May her cat soon be healed. And prayer ID number 37468KL needs herself, her mother, and KA's visas to come through. They need to have the consul officers be moved to intercede for them so that they get their visas approved. Prayer ID number 37467EB prays that he'll become more confident in himself and happy. May we send him a powerful crucible of courage, that he has the confidence and power to do what he needs to do. And finally, prayer ID number 37466 AM needs for her Robert to commit to her and for his love and desire to burn intensely. May these prayers be answered. May the higher spirits answer these prayers, and may they all come true for those who pray sincerely. Stone of the Week, and then we'll be talking to our special guest tonight, Mr. Ron Shank, spiritual worker. Our Stone of the Week is Heliodor, which is a form of beryl. Not, that's B-E-R-Y-L, not B-A-R-R-E-L. And beryl is a golden or yellow form of the stone beryl, and it is a comforting stone. It's got strong energies to bring willpower and personal power to bear on any challenge. It's used to remove emotional debris and emotional toxins from people who have such things. It's used in folk and crystal healing to remove toxins from the body. It's used to treat the spleen, liver, and pancreas in folk healing. It is a comforting stone. It assists a person in empathizing with others and to feel comfortable while they do so. It's a high-energy stone. It resonates with spiritual and psychic development. It's good to wear this if you're having difficulty understanding the problems of a close friend or family member. It gives you a buffer between you and them. By holding the stone in your hand while in the presence of these people, empathetic abilities will grow, and you become more adept to feel the other person's emotional needs, and you develop understanding with what's upsetting them. It's suggested that if you do this, you also wear or hold a piece of red jasper, which helps ground you. It gives you the earth energy along with this psychic energy as well. I'll tell you that the reason we're talking about Heliodor this week is that this is a stone that's been linked with enlightenment. Heliodor means, it's a Greek, in Greek it means gift of the sun. It was believed that the sun, God, Helios, gave it to the Greeks, and it's always been linked with energy. I will tell you that it's also used to give people joie de vivre, the joy of life. It stimulates the mind, and it promotes a clear head, and it returns the will to live, basically. It's one of the stones I recommend for people who've just lost their drive. Sunstone, Heliodor, and citrine. Those three in a little bag you carry around, and it gives you the oomph. It gives you that will to live again. It gives you courage, equilibrium, emotional stability, and the will to live again. So that is our stone of the week, Heliodor. Not one you hear about every day. It's not like hearing about rose quartz. You don't hear about that every day. So I hope you enjoyed that. So now let me introduce our guest of the week, Mr. John Shank, who is a semi-retired psychic worker who lives in Virginia. We're going to discuss his book that he has written, Three Steps to Consciousness. This is a book that has intrigued me very much. I read this some time ago, actually, and I believe this is a transcription of a workshop that Ron gives. Ron is semi-retired, although he stays very busy. I believe he's mostly busy now offering books and teaching workshops. So, Ron, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Mr. John. Nice to be here. I was interested in that stone. I've never heard of Heliodor before.
Well, I was looking for some more obscure stones. We've been talking about the potboiler stones, rose quartz and selenite and everything, and I thought we should bring about one of the more unusual stones, especially stones related to the topic of the show tonight, which is awakening. So I was looking through your book, and it's very interesting. So your contention in this book, and it's one I agree with, is that most of us walk around half asleep or even fully asleep.
Yes.
Yeah, so you describe three steps, and so tell us what's your premise here? What do you mean when you say we're not awake?
Well, it's one of those difficult things to talk to people about is mental states. English doesn't have an awful lot of words like some languages do to describe our inner states. And sure enough, I realized just myself years and years ago that. Well, let's imagine that you're driving from your house to your job, as you do most days of the week, and as you're driving along, all of a sudden it dawns on you that you don't remember that last intersection that you go through every day. You have no memories of the fact that you went through it. You must have, because you're beyond it, but it's not there in your memory. You know, did you run someone over? Was there traffic at that intersection? You have no memories of it. And it's rather kind of scary to think about that. And to my mind, I had started investigating what was that all about. And it's sure enough. It does seem to turn out that there's a certain percentage of our day that we're just not there at all. I mean, just barely anyway, minimally. And it's, well, we all know about sleep. We do that at night. We close our eyes and mostly our consciousness is gone. Sometimes we dream, sometimes we don't. And it's a passive state. Not very much information gets into us at all. And it's a state we all know about. So it was fun to discuss that because we're familiar with it. And then there's the next step. Let's imagine it is a series of steps, like up the stairs maybe. That second step then is awake. Somewhere between sleep and awake, there's this threshold, and all of a sudden, our eyes are open, and we hear the birds chirp outside, and we smell the coffee, and there we are. And now it's no longer such a passive state. Now we can actually take some action, and now a higher level of information is coming into us, and we can process it and use it. And one of the insights, I think, is that the difference between those two states is a huge step. I mean, it's the difference between living your life and being in a coma for the rest of your life. It's almost the difference between life and death in a way. It is then said, and I fully agree, that with some practice, you can stay more awake. Just like with sleep, sometimes there's deep sleep where you can't hardly be aroused. If someone hollers and screams and shakes your shoulder, it takes you a minute. And then again, there's those times like a new parent where the baby cries and instantly you're awake.
Oh, yeah.
When you're awake during, when you're awake during the day, there are also degrees of it. Sometimes you're half paying attention. You're kind of partly there and semi-daydreaming. But then again, there are those moments when the beautiful sunset just happens and you look at it and, wow, there you are. And you're suddenly aware that you're there, and you're totally focused on your surroundings, what's going on. And that's certainly more conscious than you were back there in that daydream, stare-out-the-window state. And if you continue, let's imagine that that's not a series of steps. Let's say it's a ramp going up slowly from sleep up a bit and then to awake. And let's imagine that then there's a third step up there beyond that. It's different between sleep and awake, as the first two are, and it's an increase in that awareness, that consciousness, if you will. It's less passive. There's even more information available, and we're even more aware of who we are and where we are and what's around us and what's happening, and it gives us a tremendous advantage in being able to react, to process more information, to make better choices, and it's. I just call it that third step of consciousness, and it can be gained through practice, through meditation, mindfulness meditation, if you want to call it that, I guess many have. Mm-hmm. And that was the workshop we were working on when this some years back at a public park here in Virginia, when a woman sat down and took notes on the things that I said, and bless her soul, she went home and typed this all out. It must have taken her days. And as it turns out, I learned the story many, many years later. She remained anonymous initially. She just kind of mailed it to me, and there it was. And she didn't say who she was or why. And as it turns out, in the long run, she had a very jealous husband. And she didn't want him to know she was doing this because he'd get jealous and think there was something going on between us, I guess. I think I know who she was because I know the people that came to my workshops fairly regularly, and I think I know who it was, but I've never talked to her about it. And in the book, I thank her very kindly for her hard work, because it was a lot of work. And it's written from that standpoint of the talk, much as I would give it. And that's it. It's mostly descriptive of the different states, so that you can recognize them and feel them and remember and experience them, because I tried to use language that the reader can identify with and say, yes, I know that, I've been there, I feel that. Because if you can get into that, you can then perhaps get a taste of that third state up there beyond the first two steps.
You talk about traumatic events being especially more vivid than, you know, say, dinner, you know, having lunch with a friend. You talk about traumatic states being more vivid.
Oh, heavens, yes. I remember this was some years back. If you remember the people that have, say, just come home from overseas where there's bad things going on, there's war and shooting, and some of the military guys who had returned, they would say that although they it was a horrible experience in many ways, and they really didn't like it a lot, they realized that they were more alive in those moments than they were at other times. They were forced to be totally awake, because every sand dune, every wall, every window, every door could have someone behind it trying to shoot at them or kill them. And so, of course, your senses are totally alert, and you're super aware of everything. And that state became something that they were very conscious of. And they found it kind of almost addicting, that they wanted to be more conscious like that when they came back home over here, but found that without some sort of outside push, they couldn't do it as well. And sadly enough, though, it's those memories in that state that we remember the most.
Right.
And so for them, sometimes they're unpleasant memories, where I think the stress syndrome starts from.
Yeah, it's almost as if they were etched deeper than the casual memories, even the more pleasant memories. Do you think it's true that we remember bad events stronger, that bad events leave a deeper imprint on us than pleasant events?
Perhaps so, if you will. I think the modern psychology is starting to realize that that may somehow be true, that we pay more attention to threats than we do positive stuff, because it's a matter of survival. We hear a noise in the bushes, it's better to be on the safe side, to think it may be that saber-toothed tiger and be a little bit worried about it and pay more attention, than to just say, "Ah, heck, it's nothing." So they think perhaps we're wired just a bit to pay a little attention to stuff that seems a little bit of a threat, or a little bit worrying, a little bit possibly threatening.
Yeah, the fear and the survival instinct would trigger this hyper awareness, or this greater awareness.
It certainly can. Course,
yeah, I guess it would. And whereas if you're you're having a very happy memory, you would tend to be more relaxed. But it seems like you could train yourself. You could nudge yourself and say, "Okay, remember this. Wake up, remember this. This is good."
Surely. You don't need to jump out of a plane with a parachute in order to get excited enough to remember it. Certainly that's true.
Yeah, but I'll tell you that one of the strongest memories I have, it's so clear it's like it's yesterday, and my son is 35 years old. I remember holding my son in one hand right after he was born and looking into his eyes. Like it was yesterday. I remember that like it was yesterday. That's as clear as it was yesterday. And that's one of the clearest memories I have, and it hasn't eroded a bit over 35 years.
Well, those high peak memories can be wonderful. I know women that can remember everything in their wedding, who said what, who ate what, you know, the weather, the time of day, all of that stuff. And it's sure enough, I can remember some very pleasant times. I, too, have a son, and I can remember when he was very young, he and I spent time together, how wonderful that was.
It is. I remember being aware, too, that I was aware. I said, I'll never forget this. This is the best moment of my life. And I was aware of that, you know, hey, pay attention. I said,
well, you're not like everybody,
though,
John. You're not like everyone. A lot of people don't pay any attention and don't know. Heaven knows, you watch people walk down the street with their phone in front of their face, thumbprinting and typing away to people, and bang, they walk into the side of the building or into the lamppost because they're not there. We used to laugh in the workshop and call people zombies, which was kind of a sneering term, I admit, but because so many people are walking around and they aren't there. I mean, you can see them out there every day of your life. Sadly enough, you can see them behind the wheel of a car a lot, too. They're driving. They're oblivious to who's behind them, beside them, and what's in front of them sometimes.
Well, I remember going to the Chicago Institute of Art, and, you know, they have Monet's there, and, you know, the Seurat, you know, Sunday in the Afternoon with George.
Right.
And people would walk up to them, take a picture of them, and walk away. And, you know, you can get better pictures on the Internet than you can take. And I said, you know, there are the Monet Chapel paintings where he painted the chapel at different times of day, and you can stare at those things for hours and still find stuff in them. How he found the complementary colors and the shadows, you can look at those things for hours, and people would walk up to them, take a picture, and walk away. And I said, this is Monet. And there's Van Gogh paintings there, the self-portrait where he's glaring at you. That's in the Chicago Institute of Art. And people walk up, take a picture, and walk away. And I was thinking, I saw the Picasso exhibit at MoMA, and the same thing. There was a retrospective. This is Picasso. He changed the face of art, and they take a picture and walk away. I stood there for an hour in front of the mandolin, the guy playing the mandolin. I watched it for an hour. And I thought, what's wrong with you people? This is Picasso. You know, they closed the museum around me. They had to run me out. So I think, you know, awareness is a choice, isn't it?
It is. Sadly enough, a lot of people don't understand that, or they're not aware that awareness is a choice. So that's why people like me are out there to smack them a little bit and say, hey, well, like you said about the man with the art, I can remember going to a concert in my younger years, and the Walkman was new in those days. And I can remember a couple of people in the concert in front of me with their Walkman on, listening to the cassette tapes of the people that were up on the stage while they were up on the stage. And I wanted to go up and pull them out of their ears and say, hey, it's right here.
That
but
blows
I don't
my
know.
Mind.
So, yeah,
it's
yeah.
It's being whack. You know, you're talking about meditation. Some people think meditation is falling asleep, I guess. You know, you go to Zendo's, the Zen master walks around with a stick to hit people to wake them up because, you know, they go to sleep.
Yes.
Yeah, they fall asleep. So he'll give you a good whack with a stick just to wake you up, because a lot of times in meditation, people will fall asleep and they mistake it for enlightenment. People will say, yeah, I started meditating at 3:15, and then I blinked my eyes, and it was 4:25. I enter Satori? Did I enter Samadhi? No, you fell asleep. Because that happened to me when I was really young. I had a teacher, and I said I was looking at the clock, and half an hour just went by like that. He goes, you fell asleep. And
sure.
You get on the Buddhist forums, and people say, I think I've mastered entering Samadhi or in the jhana because an hour just passed. And I think a lot of the out-of-body experiences of that, too. People fall asleep and dream that they've flown to the Himalayas or something, and then they come back and say, hey, I went out of my body. Yeah, and you were snoring really loudly while you did it, too.
Yes, indeed. Sure.
So I think that when I was taught meditation, I was told that you cultivated an attitude of joyous expectation, joyous awareness, alertness, joyous alertness, like you were listening for something to happen and watching for something to happen. Do you find that that's what you talk about being an active participation, active awareness? Do you find that's similar to what you're talking
about?
That's
a very good sentiment to have it said exactly that way. You were speaking of the going to sleep. They had a get-together on the West Coast. This was, God, years ago in the 70s. They had some high-ranking, there were six of them, gentlemen came over from Japan who were Zen masters, or so they said, and they were doing sitting meditation. And at least two of them fell asleep. And I was horrified. I mean, these are supposed to be, I thought, this is a con, this is a ripoff. But I soon realized that that's a very common thing. And yes, that man with that stick, the enlightenment stick, or we used to have different names for it. They weren't so nice. If you felt yourself drifting off, and we all do that, God knows I do it, they would walk up, you would put your hands together in what looks like a prayer gesture to us in front of your face, and you're in fact saying, please, would you give me a smack? And so he'll walk up behind you and whack, whack, one
yes,
on
sir,
each
may
of
I have
the
another.
Tops of your shoulders. Yes,
yes
and,
sir,
and,
may I have another.
And then, and you're supposed to imagine that you're saying thank you to them. You kind of put your hands together, and then you can go back to meditation, because now you're there again. And it is a help, curiously. It really does help. And he's not trying to beat you black and blue. He's not doing it that way. But
it's just enough to bring you back to that moment. It's just really kind of a little tap. You know,
it's very helpful. It really is very helpful, for sure.
Yeah, it brings you back into the moment. Yeah. Because a lot of times you do in meditation, you'll tend to wool gather, you'll daydream, and
that will
bring you back into the moment. So you recommend meditation to help develop awareness and awakefulness.
Well, I say that to some extent that is my meditation, is the sitting there and being aware of that moment. That is the meditation itself. As you said earlier, some people come and say, well, I want to learn to meditate because I'm so tense and I can't take drugs, and so I want to do that instead, because they see meditation as a tranquilizer,
right,
as a way to get stoned. And although you can sometimes have some secondary effects, such as being very relaxed and stress goes down for sure, it's measurable, but that's not a goal. If you go into meditation saying, I'm going to be smart, I'm going to be super aware, I'm going to be better than everybody else, I'm going to be more hip, I'm going to be more, then you're wasting your time because it's not a foot race to be run. Everyone sits there and you just are there to be there. It's difficult in our modern society to do that with our cell phones and our tablets, you know, and our cars. And it's difficult to sit and actually do nothing for just 10 minutes. Most people almost can't literally do it.
Well, you know, Mr. Tomlin, our founder, had exercises in his book that he wrote in 1917, and one of those was to hold a small crystal ball in your hand and focus all your attention on it for 5 minutes. And he said, try it.
Absolutely.
It's very difficult. And this was in 1917, before all that, and he said focusing your attention on something for 5 minutes is very difficult.
And he said it would take time.
Yes, 5 minutes. He said, focus all your attention on that crystal ball. Look at it from every angle. He said, try it. It's very difficult. This was 1917. When if you had a high school education, that was like having a college education today. You had to memorize the multiplication tables and learn two languages and all sorts of stuff.
Oh, my.
Yeah, it was very different back then. And that was, you know, people used to listen to the radio with great intensity. They didn't have television. You know what? You're talking about tablets and stuff. I attended a talk. I was a member of a marketing group, and this fellow came in. He was an efficiency tiger. He went into businesses and told them what they were doing wrong. And business was good for him because efficiency was way down and errors were way up for a lot of businesses. And he went in and he found out it was because people were being interrupted by checking their emails and by tweeting and Twitter and Facebook and all of this.
Yep.
And he did some research, he and his colleagues, and it turns out that if you are in deep concentration in a task and you're interrupted, it can take you as long as 20 minutes to get back into that focused state. And
people would check their email
every 5 or 6 minutes.
Sure, and they do that
between
in
Facebook, email,
couples doing that at the restaurant.
Yeah,
sure.
People were checking their email anywhere from every 5 minutes to every 10 minutes, and so nobody was ever in a concentrated state of mind. Nobody was, and people were trying to multitask, and you know that's a myth. Nobody can really multitask. You can.
Oh, I'm glad to hear you say that.
Yes.
Good for you.
Well, it's a fact. You can tandem task. You work in tandem. You can do two things in tandem. You go back and forth between them. People were trying to multitask difficult tasks, and they were being interrupted by emails and texts and things. And so he implemented a policy where people could check their emails twice a day. It was driving some people crazy for a while. And but efficiency went way up, errors went way down, and over time people got to like it. I found out that was true. I was trying to learn to play piano, and I would be working very hard on trying to learn something, and the phone would ring, and I'd sit back down, and it would take me 15 to 20 minutes before I could get back into the concentrated state necessary to do that, or you know, studying or something. So his point was that nobody today is ever in a state of complete concentration on the job or anywhere. And that's why the texting and driving is so dangerous. You're never paying attention. You actually don't see what's in front of you. It's like a negative hallucination. You just don't see it. You're never focused on what's in front of you. And that's very scary.
I had a study that I was checking here just a couple of weeks ago, and the man said that according to his best research, the human mind can handle about 110 bits of information per second or per minute, whatever that small amount was, coming in, and to be able to juggle it and to deal with it. To talk with someone sitting there face-to-face across the desk and really focusing on them takes about 60 of those units, if you will. And so if you add a television or a tablet or a new Apple Watch phone, if you add another one of those in and then a third one in, you're right. You're scattered so thin that each one of them is being hurt. No one is 100% there at all.
And there goes your life. there goes your life.
Yeah,
you know, you're fragmenting your attention into so many different directions that none of it is making a lasting impression on you.
Sure. I knew a couple executives that bragged about how they could multitask and do six things at once, and they were running themselves ragged. And I think they would have done a lot more if they'd have done less and got an assistant to do some of them instead. They would have been more efficient at it in the long run than they were. Oh, certainly.
I know if I try to multitask, something is going to get done incorrectly. There's going to be a mistake that gets in somewhere. Somebody's going to call me and say, I hate to complain, but something isn't right with this. And, you know, if I try to multitask, if I try to do some, you know, three or four different things at once, something is going to fall through a crack. So I try to do one thing, then switch to another thing, then switch to the third thing, and just do it that way. I don't try to do it all at once. Also, if I'm trying to have a conversation with somebody and they keep, you know, their phone's going beep, 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 and they're texting back and forth, I ask them I said, can that wait? Can you turn that off and put it in your pocket? Can that wait?
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes they get offended. It's like, you know, if I'm standing next to somebody and they're smoking, I said, you know, do you mind? I don't want, you know, you can smoke, but I don't want to smoke. And, you know, sometimes they get offended.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you have a right, if someone's talking to you, to their attention, you know, it's like, do you want to talk to me or talk to them? You know, you got to make a decision.
Well, I had a client, a woman that I was talking to. We were discussing some problems of hers. And one of the things she mentioned to me, which I found just mind-blowing, was she said that sometimes in the middle of her sex, her husband would reach over and pick the thing up on the desk next to her and look at it, the little screen. And I thought, there's a man that doesn't know what... Yes, can you imagine you're doing something and you reach over and pick it up and glance at it? You know, that's the lack of total respect, you know, damn it. That's just nuts.
I see couples out, and sometimes you can tell they're on a first date, and the guy keeps checking his phone, and you can tell this is a first date, and he just...
Probably the last.
Well, you would think, except that's almost acceptable behavior in younger people now. And the phone is, first of all, it's out on the table, and he keeps picking it up. She'll be talking, and he keeps picking up and looking at it. And to me, that's like saying, you know, whatever you're saying to me, I'm not really into it.
Yeah, it's not that important compared to this, yeah.
And I said, man, if you want to get in with this woman, you should be utterly fascinated at every syllable that is coming out of her mouth, and you should be utterly fascinated. You should be mesmerized by her if you want to show her that you're into her. And
if she's not holding your attention that well in the first place, she should find someone else.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, she will. She'll find somebody that's into her.
Amen. Amen.
But you see that a lot. You see that quite a bit.
Attention
is fragmented and fractured. So, what would you suggest? You talk about running mental tapes too. I'm fascinated by this concept.
Well, the idea is that not only do we spend a lot of time often. There's a word in Japanese called boketo, and it means staring off to space and fuzzy-minded and not thinking of anything in particular. And we do that, and we know about that. But the next thing that we do is we run stuff inside our heads. I call it running tapes, or like running little movies inside your head. You think about what you said at that last time you were talking to so-and-so, and how it turned out, and what you could have said, darn it, instead of that, or what you should have really said was. So you run another little tape and make it up. Sure, and then you rewrite it six or eight times, and then you think, well, that was pretty good. By the way, next Friday I have this doggone thing coming up at 3:00 p.m, and the next thing you know, wherever you are, it's back in your past, something that you've already done, and you're reliving it, or it's something in your future where you're projecting out there and trying to do something about it now, and fretting it and planning it and scoping it out, and If you spend your time in your past, that's what's going to run your life as your past. If you spend your time thinking about the future, that's what's going to determine what goes on now as your future. And it's better to be here in that moment rather than running these little tapes inside your head of fantasy. If you remember your old Star Trek days, there was the holodeck where you went up and you took the computer and pushed buttons and it made a fake world that you could do things in to practice,
sure,
to learn things.
Sure, yeah.
And we have one of those inside our brain. It's called our imagination. And sometimes we go up there and turn it on, and we mistake one for the other.
Yeah.
You know, I tell people all the time that thinking about food, reading the diet books, and eating seem similar in a lot of ways because food is involved, but they're not the same thing. They're not the equivalent. A lot of people spend most of the time inside their head, living in there, and that's, sadly enough, that's not real life. So many people that I find over the years that were, especially big back in the 80s, I would guess, the spiritual searchers that were looking for something, and I would try and figure out what they were looking for, and they said, well, they didn't really know, but they said they could tell desperately that something was missing from their life. There was just something that wasn't there, that was something real they were missing out on.
Those people are still here.
And in talking to them, I've come to decide that for a great share of them, what's missing from that life is them. They're not in their own life. They're somewhere else. And so it doesn't seem real, and it doesn't seem satisfying, and it doesn't seem as intense as it should be and is if they were paying attention to it at the moment. And I think people that would spend some more time meditating and being aware and being mindful, some of that stuff will go away, that dissatisfaction, because they will start finding that life can be quite nice if you're there in the blasted thing while you have it.
Oh, my goodness. You know, that's correct. You know, I believe that this is a problem with a lot of people. They're not present. They're not participants in their life, in their own life. They are observers of their life.
Yes.
They're not participants in that. And, you know, I said they're still there. They'll sit down, you're doing a reading for them, and they say, I'm looking for something, you know, I'm searching for something, and can you tell me what that is? And you know, this is putting a big burden on a spiritual advisor. You know, can you tell me what it is that will make me happy forever for the rest of my life? And what I've decided is that, You know, they seem to think that the universe has a plan for them, that there's somewhere out there a record, a plan, that there's engraved in stone an answer for them in particular. And I've said this to people. I said, you know, I'm going to tell you something that a lot of psychics or readers don't tell you. I said, a lot of psychics and readers will tell you that, you know, that you have a destiny, that there's a plan, that the universe, you know, capital U, has a plan waiting for you out there to find it. And I said, I'm going to tell you something entirely different. The universe is a big, empty, cold place. It consists mostly of empty space, very cold, that can kill you in a lot of very painful ways if you don't watch yourself. There's no destiny, there's no plan, except the one that you choose and make for yourself. So what you're looking for is nothing.
Very good.
You can't.
Yes.
You're not going to find this out in a rock, and no guru is going to tell you what it is. Pick something. Pick anything, and then pursue it with everything you have, and then you will feel utterly satisfied. I don't care what it is. You want to paint, write, play guitar, play banjo, whatever. Pick something. Just pick something, and quit searching.
I know so many people out there taking courses and studying and practicing, and my thought is that life is not here for us to prepare to be alive. Life is here for us to live. So many people spend their time preparing to have a life that's all they wind up doing.
Well, the dumbest thing I've ever heard is it's not a destination. The destination doesn't matter. It's the journey. And I said, no. That's, you know, you got 90-year-old guys in school, you know, professional students, it's like you're going to drift aimlessly. You're going to be a rolling stone. You're never going to have any kind of a sense of purpose. Pick something and work on it. You know, what did you want to do when you were a kid? You know, just pick something and work on it. And while you're working on that, you're going to be so utterly absorbed in the moment. You're not going to think about this bohemian, romantic, spiritual quest, you know, your soul all tormented. There's the story of Bodhisattva. He's staring at the wall, and the prince comes over, and he says, my soul is in torment. And Bodhisattva says, show me your soul. And he goes, well, I can't. He goes, well, then leave it alone. There's nothing wrong with it. Leave it alone.
Excellent. Yes. There was one of those stories about.
That. Well, then it's at rest. Leave it alone.
There's a similar story where. Go ahead. I don't mean to interrupt.
No. Go ahead, Ron. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say that there is a story similar to that where the man comes and he says, "Well, great teacher, I have 82 problems." And he says, "Oh my, that's a lot. What are they?" And so for an hour, he sits there and tells him about his children and his business and his cattle and his wife and the weather and his arthritis. And when he's done, he says, "There, I have those 82 problems." And the teacher says, "Ah," he says, no, you've missed one. You have 83. And he says, "Really? What is it?" And he says, "Well, that problem is the one where you think you're not supposed to have any problems."
Well, there you go.
And that's kind of the way it is. Yeah, there's going to be stuff out there, but show it to me. Come on, bring it on. Where is it?
Yeah, and a lot of times I'll talk to people, and they just have too much time on their hands, and that's the big problem. They have so much time that they can think about all the things that are wrong. And I just say, you know, get busy with things. And you know, lonely people have problems, and married people have problems. And Buddha said you exchange single person problems for married people problems, basically. And everybody's got something. Everybody's got something that that eats at them. And there is no stress-free existence. And if you had it, you'd be bored. You wouldn't know what to do with yourself. But we got this. So you have these mental tapes. So and you talk about there's a narrator's voice in your mind. And then you ask this really interesting question. You say, "Do you think that this narrator's voice is the real you?" And most people do. They think the voice in their head that's talking to them is the real them. So,
and then I want to know who's behind that voice. Show me that person behind that voice.
Do you think maybe that voice is comprised of the voices of all the people around them that they know? Or is it just pieced together like you'd cut, you know, different tapes together and splice them together?
That easily, yes. And all those years of doing just exactly that, surely. Yep. And that makes good sense. How do you see it, John?
Well, you know, there was a guy named Cameron who had the theory, the mirror personality theory, and he said that our personality develops as mirrors of the people we're exposed to. And that's had a lot of support in many circles. You don't develop your personality in a vacuum, that you mirror all the people that you've ever been exposed to. And that's how your personality develops. You know, your parents and the people, your teachers, that your personality is mirrored by the people you're exposed to. And so there's a great deal of sense in that. There are people you admire, and you pick up some stuff from them. And, you know, people, you know, you read, you have literary influences and stuff you see on TV. And, you know, how much of your ethical standards did you get from role models you saw on television? You know, I used to run home from school and watch Star Trek. It was on 2 days a week. I was the first one Star Trek, and, you know, and I loved Kirk and Spock, and a lot of the moral codes I got in my life it's really funny, from Star Trek. That was when I was 6 or 7 years old. A lot of my early moral teachings I got from watching Star Trek and Wild Wild West and shows like that. You know, the idea of justice and doing the right thing and having a moral limit and logical, you know, things had to make sense. And, you know, you had to think things through before you acted. And that there were two sides of things. Kirk was right brain and Spock was left brain. You know,
exactly.
Yeah, and there was, you know, my son grew up, and one of his role models was Optimus Prime from the Transformers. And he complained bitterly when the movie violated Optimus Prime's ethical code. He said, "No, Optimus Prime would not do that." I mean, he was really offended by that. And I said, "You're right, Optimus Prime wouldn't do that. He would not have killed someone who asked him for mercy." And I said, they didn't get the character. So I think you're right. I think that there is a great deal of that are other people's voices, but I think that there is an active participant that chooses what parts of other people you put in there, and it's like when someone learns to write, you know, they emulate other authors. They're, you know, novelists. They emulate other authors for a while, and then over time,
mm-hmm. Sure.
You know, it's like you make beef stew over time. You know, it's not carrots and potatoes and peas anymore. It's beef stew. You know, it becomes a pastiche. It becomes something original. But then again, you just have people who run other people's tapes. You know, you'll hear some pseudo-intellectual at a party going on, and you go, okay, that sounds awfully familiar.
And, sure, you know, sure.
He's just quoting something.
He's quoting Goethe or, yeah, someone else, yeah. You know, that thing you were...
Taking it for his own. He said, oh, wait a minute, I just saw that on Facebook. You know,
yeah, exactly, right.
His original thought. So I think that there's different choices you make there. You can take other people and absorb them, integrate them into yourself and become your own person, or you can take other people and just mirror them, you know, just take them in and repeat them like a parrot, I suppose. So you can be an active participant or a passive participant.
Well, hang around good people. Don't hang around the losers of the world.
Yeah,
that's what you're going to pick up.
The company you keep makes a big difference. It makes a big difference, the company you keep. And, you know, if you
put
believe
Star
in...
Star Trek in.
If you believe in karmic influences, you know, you bring into this life some imprint, you know, something that
mm-hmm.
might lean you toward that. You know,
mm-hmm.
if you're born into a schmucky family... you can either be like them, or you can say, geez, my family's a bunch of schmucks. I don't want to be like them. And you don't
it may take a while to break loose from that and to see it, but you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
We don't have a lot of...
At some point, you have an awakening moment, and you say, I don't want to be like these people. And so you may absorb some of the positive qualities. You know, they may be cunning or clever, but completely immoral, and you say, well, I think I'll be cunning and clever and moral. You know, and ethical. You know, you just see.
Well, that's a matter of choice again.
That's
a choosing thing. So much happens around us. Frankl's will to power. He gets into the idea that we have so little choice sometimes about what happens to us in the world. He was one of those guys who spent his time in a German prison camp, and he said they had no control whatsoever. He said, but the control that we do have, all of us have to some extent, is that we can choose how we react to what happens out there.
Yes, yeah.
We can't control what happens, but we can control how we... It's like I tell the young guy, I said, yes, everyone we see, every time you see that beautiful young lady goes by, you whistle at her, and eventually you make some kind of a catty remark when she walks by. You don't have to do that. You know,
right.
I assure you, you feel something, an attraction, because she's fine to look at, but that doesn't mean you must say something. You can keep your damn mouth shut. You know, you have a choice in that. It's not automatic.
That's exactly right.
You mentioned Star Trek, you know, in David Alexander's biography of Gene Roddenberry. Gene was real well aware of the ethical stuff that went into his storylines, and he was very careful, but he tried to make it as much as he could.
A lot of those were moral tales.
Yeah, so you had good stuff to listen to there, John.
They were moral tales, yeah, and the spinoffs didn't have that. They were adventure stories, many of them did not have that moral tale that were so prominent in stories from the 70s. A lot of the shows in the 70s were moral tales. Bonanza and the David Carradine Kung Fu show and... Dragnet even, but Dragnet was very heavy-handed with a moral tale. It was like if you step out of line, you're going to go to jail forever. And Bonanza always had good moral tales, and The Rifleman. Of course, it opened up with him going down the street shooting somebody about nine times and then looking at you like, you're next. Do you remember that opening? He put the bullets in the gun and then look at you like, you want some of this?
Yep.
And he's like, no, Chuck,
yep.
I don't. I really don't.
No, thank you.
No, you just shot that guy about 10 times. You know, and once would have done it, and you shot his dead body or his friends or whatever. You shot him and the widow woman and the horse.
And the horse.
And some stray dog, and then you're reloading. He's looking at you like, you want some of this? No, really, no. I'm not doing anything, man. I'm kind of law-abiding. No, just keep that away from me, man. So, you know, there was a good moral tale. Zorro, you know, all those had really good moral lessons. And, you know, you wanted to be like these guys. You wanted to right wrongs and do good justice, you know, right wrongs, be justice, bring justice to those who needed it. And, you know, we all do that in our own way. I can't dress up in a cape and a mask and go out and sword fight people, but, you know, I can do them with, you know, I can help people the way I help them, you know, bring them spiritual help and, you know, try to write them with root work and get the spirits on it. And, you know, with our show like this. We have 4 minutes left, Ron. What advice would you give people?
Fine.
What kind of how do we get your book? And how much is it? Can people get your book?
Heck yes. It would be an ebook version, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Well, my email address is Ron R-O-N Martin M-A-R-T-N without an I.
Ron Martin.
M-A-R-T-N right at Errols E-R-O-L-S. .com, Errols.com. And it's $10. Send me $10.
Okay.
PayPal will do it. PayPal to Ron Martin at Errols.com, $10, and I'll zap you a copy, no problem.
That's good, and it's a fairly big book. It's over 50 pages.
It's 80, I think it's 85 pages long.
Oh, yeah, 85 pages, that's right, yeah. Yeah, it's a fairly big book. It has a lot of good material, a lot of advice in it. What advice would you give people who want to get out of this rut that they're in?
Wake up. Be where you
wake
are.
Up.
Smell the coffee. Yeah.
Pay attention.
Be
you
here.
Know, I was thinking about this, and you know, the Buddhist monk Thich Nhat Hanh, who a friend of mine can't pronounce that, so he calls him Tic Tac Toe. Thich Nhat Hanh has written a lot about paying attention and being aware of the moment. He has these meditations where you chew a raisin and you concentrate on the taste of the raisin. And he's got one on eating chocolate, which is very good. He talks about opening the wrapper and dwelling on the source of the chocolate, how the bean was cultivated and how it got into your hands, and then you put the chocolate in your mouth and you let it melt and you concentrate on the sensation of this. But he's got, you know, there's a website, mindful.org, that has a lot of Thich Nhat Hanh's
techniques
on meditation. And one I was looking at, he says that by taking a moment to pay attention to something as simple as turning on a water faucet, we give ourselves the opportunity to be aware of how things in our lives come, go, and transform, which makes us less likely to take them for granted. Instead, we can, for even a moment, be awake to the transitory blessing they are, and certainly we can carry this habit out into the larger world, applying it to whatever we find ourselves doing or encountering. Turning on the water. Water flows from high mountain sources. Water runs deep in the earth. Miraculously, water comes to us and sustains all life. Looking at your empty bowl. My bowl, empty now, will soon be filled with precious food. Beings all over the earth are struggling to live. How fortunate we are to have enough to eat. Serving food. In this food, I see clearly the entire universe supporting my existence. Recycling. In this garbage, I see a rose. In the rose, I see garbage. Everything in this transformation, even permanence, is impermanent. So he teaches quite a bit of this sort of thing that you're talking about. Be aware of things. Be aware of where your food comes from. Be aware of where your water comes from. Be aware of where you come from.
Well said. Oh, I like that very much.
Oh, yeah. He writes quite a bit about that, quite a bit about the same sort of things you're talking about. Wake up. Don't take it for granted. Don't take the air you breathe for granted. Every breath you take, be aware of it and be awake. We've been talking to Ron Shank. His book is 3 Steps to Consciousness. This has been the Crystal Silence League. Ron, come back sometime.
Thank you, John. I sure will.
Yeah, we'd love to have you. Up next will be Beverly Smith in the Streets. In the Streets of Beverly Smith, a wonderful show. Ron's book can be had. Email Ron at ronmartn@arols.com, E-R-O-L-S. Thanks for coming to our show.